Well, in case you haven't figured it out, we're talking about astronomy today. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network, and we're glad to have Paul Kinzer back with us in the studio today. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, and he's a member of La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. And Paul also has a portable planetarium, and he's done shows all over the state. We'll talk to him about some upcoming astronomical events, maybe some light pollution in space, of all places, and robot probes, so much more. And we'd like to hear from you. So tell us why you enjoy observing the night sky. Do you have tips for a new astronomer? Please join in the conversation. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. Paul, it's so good to see you back here.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It certainly has. We've been talking to you, but it's always been by phone.
So yeah.
Now we've got you back. So let's start out by talking about some of the upcoming astronomical events. I hear it's a great time to see Jupiter. What's going on there?
Well, Jupiter is up in the sky as soon as it gets dark, and it's up for most of the night, and it's hard to miss. It's the brightest star in the western sky. Later in the evening. It starts in the southeast and then it moves. And actually, we can also see Saturn right now, but Saturn sets by about 9 p.m. or gets too low to see.
Okay. So are they close to each other at all?
They were earlier this year, but Jupiter has moved around in its orbit a little bit. Mm-hmm. It goes quicker than Saturn.
Okay. Is this kind of a yearly thing for Jupiter, or is it less?
It takes Jupiter 12 years to go around the sun. So every year, it's highest in the sky and best to see 1 month later than the year before. But anytime Jupiter is in the sky, it's big and bright through a telescope. It's just that 2 months ago, I think, is when it was they call it opposition, which means it was on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun. So a straight line from the sun to the Earth to Jupiter. That means that's when it's closest to Earth.
Okay.
And, and then it basically rose around sunset and was up all night long.
So what do we need to see Jupiter?
You can, kind of watch where it is in the sky as time goes on, just with your eyes. You can't miss it. But even a regular pair of binoculars, you can see four of its moons.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And something we might get into later, whenever I do that now, I remind myself, there's a probe there right now going around Jupiter in a very strange orbit. It goes far away and then it can zipping down over the North Pole and whips around in a few hours and takes amazingly close images of it. It's studying the radioactivity, all sorts of things. And there are more probes on their way to study the moons of Jupiter, where scientists think there's probably the best chance for life off of Earth in our solar system.
So on the moons themselves? Or
under the icy crusts.
Okay.
The tides created by Jupiter's gravity keep, scientists think, the inside of those moons liquid water. A couple of them probably have more water than Earth does.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Something to keep our eyes on for sure. And speaking of keeping our eyes on, you can also see that, how does it pronounce it? Pleiades?
Well, I pronounce it the Pleiades.
Pleiades, okay.
But an astronomer I follow on YouTube from England, they pronounce it the Pleiades. So.
Oh, of course they do.
Yes.
They like to be different.
Yes.
So. The Pleiades.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Then if we speak like the English,
yes.
Tell us what's going on with that.
Oh, that is such a wonderful thing to look at in the sky. Again, if you have good eyes and you're under even moderately dark skies, you might be able to even see the Pleiades from Madison. But it's always best to see anything by getting as far away from cities as you can. And the Pleiades is a thing called a star cluster. And you can tell it's not a single star with your naked eye. My naked eyes are not very good, even with my glasses on. So it looks kind of like a blob to me. But people with good eyes can see about 6 stars. People with really good eyes have counted as many as 14. And with a pair of binoculars, again, you can see dozens of stars. And right now, Jupiter and the Pleiades are not too far apart in the sky. If you look at Jupiter and then just look to the left a little ways, that's where that blob will be.
Okay.
And then if you look to the left and down a bit from there, you get to Orion, the brightest constellation in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just wonderful things to look at.
I'll be journeying up to Upper Michigan over Christmas, and the star watching up there is amazing.
Yes.
So
yes.
I'll be looking for that. Hopefully, yep. I'll see something.
Yep.
But now you talked about Orion. I think people probably know that constellation more than others, and I blame Men in Black, but.
And I'll be honest, I have not seen that
okay.
movie.
So it's kind of revolving around Orion's belt. So
That explains. Kids would always say to me when we'd be in their planetarium, "Where's Orion's belt?"
Uh-huh.
And I was like, "Why do you care about his belt?" Because they thought that's what the constellation
was
called.
Of course,
but
yeah.
That's just his belt. He has a sword and feet and a head and arms. He's holding a club and a shield.
It's a big constellation,
it is a big
right?
constellation, yeah.
It's a little bit easier to pick out than some of the other constellations, which are sometimes like, what, 4 stars?
Yeah, and Orion is great. It's basically a big rectangle with a stripe in the middle. That's the belt.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it sideways, it looks like a bow tie or a butterfly maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very easy to recognize. Those are the main stars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, our constellations are they all based on, is it Greek?
Not all of them.
Okay.
Most of our constellations, and they're recognized by scientists around the world now because, you know, the Western world gets to decide, I guess.
True.
But they all add their own constellations, but we use these. Most of the brighter ones are from the ancient Greeks, but when sailors started going further south where they could see new patterns of stars and they took astronomers with them, they were very creative. They named one the housefly. There's a microscope up there. There's a compass up there. They were boring, very boring.
Well, it might have had something to do with the grog that was on the boats. You never
know. They did also name one the other sea monster. There's actually 3 sea monsters. And
oh
so the
goodness.
Sailors, I think, had something to do with that.
I love that.
Yeah.
Now, I've always heard that you can tell a planet from a star because stars twinkle.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Well, a star, no matter how powerful your telescope, unless you're a pro and you have a really big one, it's always a point of light when you look at it. They're so far away and yet very bright, but they're a point of light. So the atmosphere always has some turbulence in it, and it makes them wiggle. Whereas a planet is, through not very big telescope at all, you can tell it's a ball. It's a disk. So more atmosphere would have to do it. Sometimes stars don't twinkle if you have really steady skies, and sometimes when they're really not steady and a planet is further away in its orbit, it may twinkle a little bit.
What makes a steady sky? I've never heard that phrase before.
Astronomers, when we have steady skies, they say we have good seeing. And that just means there's not that much turbulence.
Sure.
And that's the best time to see tiny things in the sky like planets. We might not think they're tiny, but they are. Most of the time when we're looking through telescopes, we're looking at star clusters or galaxies or whatever, and they take up more space in the sky than the planets do. So you're looking at them at lower power. But if you're looking at a planet and you want to see, say, the great red spot on Jupiter, you need pretty steady skies. And that's why astronomers care about that.
So can you tell if you have a steady sky by what's going on near the Earth, or
it's very hard to predict,
okay.
And it's mostly hard to predict, I think, because no one's really tried to figure out how to predict it the way they do rain and all of that.
Yeah.
There's a website called, I believe, cleardarksky.com. I haven't gone there in a while, but and that does use some graphs and thing, and you can actually register your own location and it will give you reports. And I know there are newer ones that I haven't really kept up on, but and so they have forecasts to tell you that. But also, if you are way into astronomy, you just go out, you look through your telescope and you go, whoa. And that whoa might mean this is amazingly great, or I'm going back inside.
So I hear in other astronomical news, there's going to be a total eclipse coming up.
Yes, and I've been preparing for it in a way since I was five.
Oh my gosh!
The 2017 one was the one. When I was 5 years old, I was looking at an astronomy book, and it showed all of the upcoming eclipses over the United States for the next 100 years. And I'm looking, and I said, the next one that's really good, 2017, I'll be 57 years old. And so my son and I went to Oregon to see that, and it was amazing. And now, 7 years later, another one, we're going to Texas. Oh. Hey, I have a sister who lives in Austin.
Oh, how nice is that?
and I've been working for the past year on a camper to get it ready to take down there.
So, I love that. Yeah. So it's going to be April 8th, in case anybody was interested.
Yes.
What's the path going to be this time?
The path goes across Mexico and then Texas and up northeast. And it ends up, I think, going over Maine and Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. But I haven't really checked that part because I have no intention of going there, because the further south and west you go, the more likely you are to have clear skies. So I'd love to go to Mazatlan, but I won't be. And this time, instead of lasting about 2.5 minutes, it's going to last over 4 minutes when you're in the center of its path. And mm-hmm. here in Wisconsin, there won't be a total eclipse, but it does pass through Indiana. So that's not too far away. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, in Wisconsin, most of the sun's going to get covered by the moon. But that just isn't the same.
Well, now that you've seen one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And people ask me, what's it like? And I said, I say, it's not like anything. It's its own thing.
That makes me want to go to Indiana. But you're right. It's probably going to be cloudy there in April. Could rain.
Yeah.
You never know. You got to take your chances, mm-hmm. right? Very fun. Well, we are talking about astronomy today. And Paul Kinzer is our guest. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. What questions do you have about the night sky or astronomy? Are you thinking about getting a telescope for someone for Christmas? Well, join in with our conversation by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and Trina LaSousa is our technical director. Now stay with us, because after the noon news today, we'll be talking about how Christmas trees are being affected by climate change. And we'll also talk a little bit about how you can make yours last just a bit longer. But right now, we are looking up in the sky. We're talking astronomy. And again, if you've got a question, give us a call. Lines are open, 800-642-1234. So one of the things that people are probably wondering about, Paul, is you were mentioning that I had mentioned earlier that you have this traveling planetarium. How does that work? Tell us about it.
It's a StarLab portable planetarium, a company started by a former teacher in the 1970s. He, as an experiment with his class, they made a dome out of a certain kind of opaque cloth, and then he started selling them. And I travel around the state to share the night sky during the day. And in the past, I mostly went to libraries during the summer because I had a job during the school year. But I'm retired now, so I'm free to do this all the time. And I haven't done it that much in the past few years because of COVID. An enclosed dome where you're all sitting right next to each other, even with masks on. That's where I finally did get COVID after almost 3 years of finding a way to avoid it. And I worked with kids. So, And yet, it's not really that big a threat anymore, and I'm ready to go out. So folks can certainly check my website, which is seeingstarswi.wordpress.com, or just look up my name, Paul Kinzer, Seeing Stars is the name of the company.
And Kinzer is spelled K-I-N-Z-E-R.
Z-E-R, yeah. Yeah.
So you go all over the state?
Yeah, I've been to so many public libraries across the country and schools, but I've gone into Illinois and Michigan and Minnesota as well.
Sure. How big is this dome?
Well, it's about as big as a room we're sitting in, but that doesn't tell the audience much.
About 15 by 15 or so?
It's 16 by 16, okay. 10 feet high, and it gets very dark in there. And once it does, I always tell people before I turn the lights out, everybody touch the floor. We're not going to leave the gym or the library or wherever you are. Because some people, including adults, get a little worried because once the stars go on, you really kind of feel like you're outside because all you see are the stars. And they move. You know, I can turn on a motor and we can go from 10 at night to the following morning in 1 minute. And some people get a little woozy, but you get used to it.
Now, you're talking about kids. I think a lot of us are probably going to be spending more time with children this time of year than we normally would.
Yeah.
What are some of the things to get them excited about astronomy, science, that kind of thing?
Well, go outside. I mean, we spend a lot of time in front of screens, and you can see some amazing astronomy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also see weird special effects and is it real and all that. You can go outside and see the real sky. And if you take some very simple things with you, like a planisphere, I brought one along today. It's basically two disks that are held together, and there's a map of the night sky for the whole year. And you turn the disks and you can tune in the time and the date. You know, you can say, well, it's 8 p.m., December 20th. You line up those two things, and there's a map of the stars, and you can just hold it and look up and see which constellations are visible. And the wonderful thing about those is, even if it's the middle of the day and it's cloudy, you can use that to try and to get your mind around how does the night sky change from day to day and hour to hour. And you can get them for $10 or even less.
Really?
Yeah. And it's, I want to spell it because it's kind of a weird word, P-L-A-N-I-S-P-H-E-R-E. And you can pronounce either planisphere or planisphere. It basically means a plane of a sphere.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Another thing is a green laser pointer. It's another great thing because when I used to try and teach folks about astronomy under the real sky, I would point and say, now that star, and they're like, which one?
Yeah.
And you couldn't really show people the constellations very easily. But now a green laser pointer, unlike a red one that we use during the day and you see a little dot, here you actually see the beam. And it's a pointer to the sky. And you can, again, get them pretty cheaply for under $20 now sometimes, although those don't work quite as well. But for under $50, you can get a really nice one. The problem with them is you can get a really not good one because this is another weird thing to me. It is illegal to use one that's more powerful than 5 milliwatts.
Okay.
Yeah. And yet you can order on eBay, you can order them that are 150 milliwatts.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you were to shine even the 5 milliwatt one into someone's eyes, it would be bad. They would have a stripe on their eye for a long time. But those other ones, people use them to pop balloons.
Oh, my gosh.
And so be careful.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they are very useful.
Okay. And we've also heard things about lasers and planes.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
It is a problem. A big problem. Sadly, they're almost always teenage boys who shine them at planes for fun.
Sure.
And they've really freaked out pilots. I even have a friend who's a private pilot who said, yeah, he's been flashed. And even if they're miles away, it may not damage their eyes, but it can freak them out and cause them to do something that could hurt someone.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, you can see at night, you can see where the planes are. It's fine to use the pointer when there's a plane. Just don't aim it anywhere near the plane.
Right. Pretty simple. Yeah. Well, we have gotten some emails, and Bill emailed, and he said he's been into astronomy for about a year and wants to make some upgrades to his equipment. Is it worth investing in a larger telescope, or should he focus on upgrading his eyepieces first?
I guess it depends on how decent the ones you have are. A lot of beginner scopes come with, sadly, the big weak points with most of them are the mounts that they're on that are really shaky, or their eyepieces. And folks who come to our club with their scopes to say, what can I do? We almost always say, oh, you need here. We have a long, long corridor at the UW La Crosse, where our club meets, that we aim their telescope down, and we will show them different eyepieces. Here's yours. Here's a not necessarily even a really expensive one, but a decent one, and their eyes get wide. So that may be what you want to do. A really good middle of the road eyepiece, not super expensive at all, are called Plossl, Plossl. They're fine. They're mostly what I use. And you can get those for $20.
Oh, well, that's
so,
not bad.
Yeah. But it also depends how big is your telescope now, how decent is your telescope, how shaky is the mount. I feel that if you don't have a really sturdy tripod that allows you to move things in slow motion just by turning a knob or with a motor, it's really, really frustrating to aim and to focus the telescope. And there's a thing called aperture fever. Aperture is basically the size of the mirror or lens, and it means opening or hole or whatever. But those of us who have used telescopes, we will decide, you know what, I've seen all this can show me. I need a bigger lens, because, frankly, the bigger the lens or mirror, all things being equal, the sharper the images will be, but mostly the brighter they will be. And most of what we see in the night sky through telescopes, the difficulty isn't how small it is, it's how dim it is. So the bigger the telescope, the more things you're going to be able to see.
Well, we have a caller, Jeff in Door County, who has a question right along those lines. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Quick question. So I live up in a dark sky designated area, and I have a rental property, and I wanted people to take advantage of seeing the stars. Somebody told me to stay away from telescopes and use binoculars because there's less messing around with stuff. And I was wondering what your opinion was of that and what kind of binoculars I should be buying.
Wow. You led me right to where I want to go. Telescopes do take much more effort to use. You can see things with them, of course, that you will never see in binoculars, simply because, again, of those larger mirrors and lenses. They allow you to magnify more, and the images are brighter. And yet, with your eye, you can see about a few thousand stars. You pick up a pair of binoculars, any pair of binoculars, and you're up to at least 100,000. So you're really upping things. You can see galaxies through binoculars. You can see all different kinds of star clusters, nebulae, which are basically clouds of gas in space. You can see those. Not as many as you would through a telescope, but all you have to do with binoculars is hold them up and look through them. There's no mount set up. I will say, though, that if you are going to use binoculars, getting a tripod, just a camera tripod, and an adapter, it's called a binoculars adapter. It's a right angle thing. You put it on your tripod, and then pretty much any decent pair of binoculars is going to have a hole right in the middle between the two lenses that you screw that adapter onto, and then you can hold your view steady. The issue with binoculars in astronomy is when you hold them up to your eyes, no matter what you do, they're going to shake a little bit. But if you have it on a tripod, you can do two things. One, the view can be perfectly steady. And two, you can step aside and let somebody else look, and they don't have to aim the binoculars. So I would say those are really, really great things to do. And again, like I said, the bigger the lens or mirror, the more you can see. And binoculars come in a lot of sizes. For astronomy, the main thing you probably want to look for, besides quality of construction, is how big those lenses are on the front. A typical pair of binoculars has two numbers, and the most common is 7x35. That means it magnifies things by 7 times, and the lenses on the front are 35 millimeters across. Those will show you quite a bit, but 10x50 binoculars, which are the ones that Jill's looking at right here that I brought along with me, those lenses, they're not twice as wide, but the way aperture works is by area. Those 50 millimeter lenses rather than 35 millimeter lenses show more than they gather more than twice the light of the 35 millimeter ones. So you're going to be able to see more things, more dim things, and everything will be brighter. So another thing you want to avoid is high powered binoculars. That 7x35 and 10x50, if you think about it, 50 divided by 10 is 5. 35 divided by 7 is 5. And that number is how big the circle of light coming out into your eyeball is, 5 millimeters across. Under dark skies, adults, our eyes, that's about how big our pupils get. So you want to use it all if you can. And there are binoculars now, and this is a lie. They claim they're 200 power or whatever, and that's just ridiculous. It's a marketing lie. But even if you were to say to get 20x50 binoculars, well, 50 divided by 20 is what, 2.5? And that means that little dot coming out, even if they're very high quality lenses, it's going to be way smaller and it's sort of a waste. So that number 5 is a good number to keep in mind. Kids, they have a superpower. Their pupils get bigger than ours. Kids can see better in the dark than ours. Than us adults, especially older adults. I'm 63, and kids will go, "Oh, look at that," and I'll say, "Look at what?" But yeah, so I hope that helped.
Okay, well, and I think that the mounting for a tripod would be perfect for what the caller was looking for. If
right.
He wants other people to enjoy it.
And so many people, they already have a tripod for a camera or something that they got somewhere along the line, mm-hmm. and many people have binoculars. And
yes.
Just look in that place between the lenses. Often there's something screwed into that little hole, so you won't even know it's there. But just try unscrewing that thing in the middle, and hey, look at that. It's a threaded hole to buy. And one of these binocular adapters, you can get them for $5 to $10.
Oh, that's a great deal.
Yeah.
Where would you suggest people go to purchase binoculars?
Well, that is an excellent point to bring up, because this pair of binoculars I have right now, they're Nikons and they're very nice. But I had a pair that was actually better as far as quality, and I ordered them online and I gave them away. Because they hurt.
Oh.
Just the way they were designed and my eye sockets, they were not comfortable to use. So if you can, try and buy binoculars that you can look through in person. They sell them, you know, a lot of big box. Walmart has them. Target used to. I doubt if they do now. But Walmart is a fine place, or any sporting goods store. They're going to have a wider selection. Yeah, if you can hold them up to your eyes and try them yourself. You don't need anything fancy. They don't need to be waterproof or anything. In fact, if they are, they're going to be heavier and harder to use. That's another thing. My wife has a pair of lightweight. These have aluminum metal parts inside, which makes them lighter. Hers is titanium, and that's lighter yet and stronger, and of course more expensive. But I did buy these binoculars new, but I've never bought a new telescope, and we bought her binoculars used and got a great deal on them, and they're very comfortable for her. And then of course you can use them during the day for
sure.
Birds or whatever.
Yeah. Gosh, use a good pair of binoculars.
Yeah, yeah.
We got an email from Amy Grace in Milwaukee. She's struggling with light pollution in her area, and she's wondering, are there any filters or techniques that she can use to enhance her observations?
Yeah, there are filters that you can use to get rid of light pollution, and they work, although the less light pollution there is, the better they're going to work in a way. But once you're, you know, in a really big city, and especially Milwaukee, the whole Milwaukee-Chicago area, Chicago actually has the worst light pollution in America. I don't know why. They're not the biggest city. But typically downtown Chicago at night, you can't see a single star. There's nothing you can do about that. You just got to get away from the skies that are so light polluted. But if you're in a place where you can... there are filters just called light pollution filters. And if you just do a search for that, you're going to find a lot of different ones. And what a filter does, though, is it blocks light. And it's going to block that light from those light polluting things. The problem now, sadly, is that some of the lights we use at night, they are wide spectrum. Instead of being a single spectrum or a single place on the spectrum that you can block and see everything else, they block a lot of it. So to filter them out, you have to block a lot of the actual starlight that's up there too. It's a real drag. It's a problem. And it's a dumb problem because we don't need to light the night up the way we do. When I was a kid, I grew up in St. Paul. We could see quite a few stars right from my front yard. We had streetlights. You could see just fine. You just didn't. It wasn't daytime. It was, you know, now we seem to want to make the light as bright as day. And that's sad.
And I think, is there a safety issue involved with that, do you think?
You mean with the reason we light the sky up more? People claim that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group called they've changed. It's called Dark Skies International now. They used to be the International Dark Sky Society. Now it's just Dark Sky International. And they did tests. They would take people in a room and they'd turn a light on. And they'd say, do you think this would be bright enough? Nah, it could be a little brighter. And no matter how many times they made it a little brighter, it could be a little brighter. It's just the way our perception is, because especially right when you go out, you think, oh, it's so dark. Humans can see in the dark as well as plenty of animals we think of as nocturnal. I was once in Nebraska in the center of the sand hills of Nebraska. It was so dark there because there are not even farm lights there because you can't farm. It's all ranch land. I could read by starlight. Not moonlight, starlight. I could read. I could see my way around the campsite where I was just fine.
So, and you've got those old eyes.
Yeah, well, I wasn't quite this old then, but yeah.
Well, we're talking about the light pollution. Haven't there been some progress with cities using lights that, go down?
Yes. Again, there are engineers who've they figured it out. I got my school district where they built a new middle school. I said, can you please have lights that turn off? Why do you need the lights in the parking lot on after 10 p.m.? So they automatically go off after 10, and you can turn them off anytime you want. Whereas plenty of places, no, the lights come on. You can't do a thing about it. They also aim straight down. They don't aim outward. We've found that light pollution, lights that shine straight up, aren't as bad as lights that shine straight out. Because straight out, they're going through all this air and really wrecking the view everywhere. Sadly, the issue is, though we have the solutions, now we're using LEDs. They're way better because they do only shine at some very specific wavelengths, but we've decided to use ones that are on the blue end of white light. And you'll see headlights on cars that are that way too. They're terrible.
They're awful.
They're not good to see at night. People think, oh, they're so bright, they make it easier to see. No, they don't. The glare from them, our eyes are really sensitive to blue light. When you get a blue light shining in your eyes at night, it turns off your night vision. The rods in our eyes, the ones sensitive to dim light, are oversensitive to blue light. So if you shine even a fairly dim blue light into your eyes at night, it turns off your rods, which can see like 1,000 times better than the cones, the colored parts. So if you have more of an amber to red light, it can be very dim, like a good pair of headlights or a campfire. It's like we evolved to see in the dark that way, and that's what we should be using. It would help everywhere. And I know, I can't remember, it was a big city out west. They put in all these lights because they got a good deal on these LEDs, and then people said, dude, what? Why are they all blue? And the public supported this. They replaced them all. They'd only been in for a couple of years, and they took them all out and put them all new ones in, and it made everything better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know as an actress backstage, we always use blue lights, and we can see just fine.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
We're talking with Paul Kinzer, the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. What's your favorite astrology gift? Astronomy.
Thank you.
Or astrology, whatever. What questions do you have about stargazing? Give us a call. 1-800-642-1234. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najeau. We're going to continue talking about astronomy right up until the noon news. And then after that, we're going to start looking at the future of Christmas trees. So make sure that you stay with us for that. And we were just talking about different colored lights. And our producer, Clara, just sent in a message that one of the car dealerships in Madison uses purple lights, and she's wondering if it has anything to do with light pollution.
Yeah, if they want to make more.
Oh, because yeah. I mean, you've got red is good, but blue is bad. But yeah. What's with the combinations?
Well, purple blue is further along the spectrum than blue, even.
Wow.
So. I'm not an expert, but I imagine that's not good. And car dealerships are actually one of the worst as far as having super bright lights on. And I understand they don't want vandalism and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Other studies have been done, though, and I don't know about car dealerships, but lights at night do not dissuade burglars and other criminals. In fact, they make it easier.
Well, yeah, they can see what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And
wow.
There's no evidence that it makes things safer.
We got a email from Gray, and he says that he's really into sci-fi and is starting to get into researching astronomy because of that. And he said, this question may be off the wall, but what are the latest theories on the formation of black holes and their potential for interstellar travel?
It's way out there.
It's a popular motif.
Yeah, it is.
Sure.
It is a popular one. Black holes are amazing. I'm not a professional astronomer, so I don't want to say too much other than the big barrier to a lot of what we all like in science fiction. And oh man, when I was young, I knew it all. But going faster than light, we don't see a way around that. But who knows, maybe we will at some point. Black holes do amazingly weird things to physics. One thing they do, though, is they kill anything that goes anywhere near them.
That's what I've always thought.
Yeah,
You know,
interesting to me, when I do my performances, a lot of times I'll say the name of a star, and someone will go, that's a character in Harry Potter. And a bunch of her character names come from stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of her names come from a lot of real places.
Yeah.
So very interesting. So Terry emailed us, and she said, "What do you know about the search for life on other planets? It's always been fascinating for her, and she's wondering if there are any updates." So we kind of just talked a little bit about that.
There are probes. There are two probes heading for Jupiter. One already launched, but it won't get there till 2031. The other one, called the Europa Clipper, is launching later this year, but it'll get there by 2030. And their sole purpose is to study the four, they call them the Galilean moons of Jupiter, because Galileo found them, because we think all of them have liquid water under their icy surfaces. And we're going to try and find out what can we do, what can we see. Some of them even give off plumes. They have water geysers, a moon of Saturn also, Enceladus. The Cassini probe flew through one of those plumes. So these are the kind of things they're checking, because where there's water here on Earth, there's life. And we don't really know of a way for there to be life without water. And so that's what's happening with that. Another thing that's happening, many of our searches for exoplanets, like the James Webb Space Telescope, one of its missions, one of the things they wanted to be able to do, was really see the atmospheres of planets around other suns. And all the time, every day, somebody is coming out with a new, ooh, we saw this in the atmosphere of this planet, and that could mean life. It could also mean a volcano. You know, we can't really tell that well. And then finally, there's SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which a lot of people kind of think is fringe, but no, it's not. So what? We might hear something. I will say, though, that this old myth that people can watch old TV shows from stars far, far away is the light reaches them. It doesn't go far enough to do that. So that's just a fun story.
I do like it.
Yeah.
We've got a call from La Crosse. Hi, John. What's your question?
Hi, Paul. This is John. I'm with the...
Oh, yeah. Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. He's in our club.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. On the radio and informing people about astronomy. That's wonderful. I just wanted to point out that I had read a story, scientific story, that apparently in the manufacturing of LEDs, now that they've been in use for a while, in some cases, as they age, they elements attenuate, and that's where you're getting these purple lights. They're not intended to be purple, but they're fading to purple.
Great. That's nice. Oh, that's too bad. But, well, thanks for letting us know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, John.
Yep.
Speaking of La Crosse, we've got Chris emailed us, and he is... been an amateur astronomer for years. I'm sorry, I have to move this around here. And he used to track sunspots during the day and try to do star trails at night. And it's been quite a while since they've had a reasonable telescope. Mm-hmm. Can you please distinguish between refractor and reflector scopes for the amateur and make a few comments about entry-level and intermediate-level telescopes that are somewhat affordable?
Yeah, okay. A refractor is the kind of telescope, you know, you think of that a pirate would use. It's got a lens out front, and then the light comes down through that lens, and then another lens called the eyepiece, and then to your eye. Whereas a reflector has a mirror, and the light shines down the tube of the telescope, bounces off that mirror. The mirror has a curve in it that makes things bigger, and then it hits another mirror and comes out the side to your eye. The most famous user in the beginning of the refractor was Galileo, and then Isaac Newton invented the reflector. And there are other types, but that's the main difference. And what that means is a telescope, a refractor, it actually needs two lenses, or the lens acts like a prism and makes rainbows. And that means the front and the back of each of those lenses has to be ground perfectly. That's four surfaces, whereas a reflector, only one surface needs to be. So reflectors, you get way more bang for your buck. For a decent refractor with a 4-inch lens, it's going to cost many hundreds of dollars. For the same price, you could get a reflector with a 12-inch lens. Now, that might be too big for some people, but it's just to point out the difference. And again, all things being equal, the bigger, the more you're going to be able to see. And because of physics that I don't quite get, the sharper the images will be in a bigger one. A very affordable telescope, there's a group called Astronomers Without Borders, might be Astronomy Without Borders. They have a deal with the telescope company Celestron, and they make a 130-millimeter, that's a little more than 5-inch mirror, in a very portable package for a very affordable price. I've been recommending that for a couple of years now. Again, I've never bought a new telescope, and the telescope I brought in today, I made. So, but there's the one nice thing in the 25, 30 years that I've been really into this, there are more telescope companies. They kind of come and go, but there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of great prices. There's a lot of very good quality stuff coming out. But a thing I advise people, don't think you're going to get a good telescope for under $200. It might look just like the nice one, but if you touch it, it bounces everywhere. Literally, some of them have plastic lenses. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, and earlier you said if you want to get a kid interested, not to get them a telescope.
Right.
Is that the reason?
It is a big part of the reason. A lot of telescopes. In my book, I sort of introduce it telling my first experience when I was 18 and I bought a telescope to look at an eclipse. It was garbage. And I paid a lot of money for it, but I didn't know what I was doing. And I could barely get anything to focus because it was so wobbly. And it was very disappointing. And that's why I've only been into this for 25 or 30 years, because I gave up on it for 20 years. I thought I did something wrong.
Sure. Very discouraging.
Astronomy clubs, if you're in La Crosse, come to ours.
Mm-hmm.
We want to help people, and they're all over. And if you don't have a club nearby, a university, talk to the physics department. They'll be able to give you pointers on where to go. Using different telescopes is a really good way to get to know, what do I want? Because there's so many different reasons you might want one. Do you want to look at the moon and planets? Do you live in an area with a lot of light pollution, or do you live under really dark skies? All of that. Do you have kids? All of that could affect what you choose to get.
Okay. And we did get a call from Joni. She is wondering what the price range is for a good pair of binoculars.
For a pair, I mean, if you're on a real tight budget, you know, go to Walmart, get their cheapy 10 by 50s, and they'll give you fine views. One thing to check, though, is use them with your eyes. Again, because it's two little telescopes you're looking to, if they're not lined up perfectly, it's not going to look good. So, you know, and even good companies, you might get one that got dropped. So if you can, check them out. But I paid $100 for my 10 by 50s. Now, they were on 50% off sale, which is the only reason I bought new ones. But between $100 and $200, there are people who I think are not like me who will spend $1,000 on a pair of binoculars. And there's no way the human eye can tell the difference. I just don't think so.
So it's more bragging rights than anything?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got this, I didn't even know it was a telescope. It does not look like one, really. Tell us about that.
I made this telescope. A lot of times people think telescopes have to be really long.
Yeah.
This one is short.
It's about 2 feet?
Not even. Mm-hmm. And what we have here, it's got a 4-inch lens in it. But its focal length, that's how powerful it is. The longer a telescope in a way, we could get into reasons why it's not entirely true, the more powerful it is. That means the more it magnifies. The bigger the lens or mirror, that means how bright it shows you things. This has a short focal length from the lens to the eyepiece. What is it? This is a 500 millimeter lens, meaning it has about a 20-inch focal length. So what it's good for is looking at wide swaths of sky. The Andromeda Galaxy, if you're looking at that, it's as wide as 6 full moons. It's very big in space. Some star clusters also very big. This is really good for looking at the Milky Way and things like that. And I got this lens from a surplus company, and the tube is a sewer pipe. And
that's what I thought when I saw it.
Yeah, and then the rings holding it together, I just made them out of plywood. But, so telescopes can really vary. And again, depending on what you want to do, I like being able to just set this up on a little mount and looking around the sky. One of my bigger, more elaborate ones, I might want to use that to look at little dim stuff or take pictures. So,
yeah, and then I know I have a friend whose brother has got some set up where he can take some amazing photos with his smartphone. Is that something fairly inexpensive? Or?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. We only have a couple of minutes. My brother called me and talked to me a long time on Sunday. He's retired. He's got money. He's not rich or anything, but he knows that we're at my house, we're not doing quite as well. He insisted on buying me this new thing that there are several versions of. It's a small telescope, but it's got a computer in it. It's got a motor in it. It's got software in it, and it's run by your smartphone. You put your smartphone up to it, and you basically turn it on, and 1 minute later, it knows where it's aimed in the sky, and you just you can do it through Bluetooth. Just tell it, aim at this and take a picture. And it just does it. And you can watch. What it does is it takes a series of 10-second images, leaving the camera open. And it might do that for 10 minutes. And while it's doing it, the picture gets brighter and sharper.
Sure.
And it's $500.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And its competition started out at about $5,000. And this company, it's Zuo, Z-W-O Optical. It's a guy in China who loves astronomy and loves helping astronomers. It's pretty cool.
That's very nice. Yeah, yeah. And then just in the like minute or so we have, we did not get to one of the gift suggestions that you had. It's a magazine, right?
Yeah, Sky and Telescope magazine. There are two magazines in America, Sky and Telescope and Astronomy. This is just the one that I prefer, that I've subscribed to for a long time. They have a wonderful website. I know a lot of people don't do paper media anymore, but in the middle of every issue is a star chart. It's a two-page spread that shows you what the night sky is going to look like this month. Yes, you can get all that on your smartphone.
Okay, well, we've been talking with Paul Kinzer, the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. And after this break for the news, we'll be back to talk about the future of Christmas trees. So stay with us.